Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is a special guest. He happens to be related to me, my son, Senator Rand Paul. Rand, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me. I don't know what you got to do to get on this program. It's hard to get on your program.
Oh, I know. It is really tough, but boy, are we have the outreach. So, there's certainly a lot of our supporters that want to hear from you. And I know your interviews can't be too long, but they're already complaining that I don't have you on long enough, and they don't even know how long it's going to last. They said you should have them on for an hour, and I know what that means. But no, I do want to start off with the book. That's why you've been making the tour and getting a lot of good attention. But, you know, in promoting your book, you also get questions on foreign policy, which I like. But when I saw the book that you wrote on socialism, I thought, he must have heard me speaking at one time, because I said, education, 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 politics comes second. We have to educate the people. And that's what you have been doing with this book on socialism, and you've been able to do it. So why don't you start off, Rand, by telling our audience a little bit about what your book is, and I certainly hope we have time also to talk about foreign policy.
Well, you know, we became alarmed, and Kelly and I wrote this book together, but we became alarmed after we were seeing poll after poll showing young people, more than 50% of young people saying, wow, they have a favorable perception of socialism. The only sort of saving grace is while many of the young people say they like socialism, quite a few of them don't know what socialism is. Only about 15 to 20% of young people can tell you that socialism is associated with the state ownership of the means of production, state ownership of private property. And so we thought, well, if not very many of them know what socialism is, maybe we need to remind them. And one of the first responses we get from people, particularly knowledgeable people, is like, boy, it shouldn't be necessary, should it? And as you and I know, and a lot of your followers know, I mean, the Austrian economists had been debunking socialism and Marx really for over 100 years. And probably Mises's book on socialism, you'd think, would have been case closed. And yet, we keep coming back to it. The socialists in England came back to it after the war. And now we have the resurgence of socialism with Bernie Sanders and with AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, preaching to this new generation that it's the way to go. And I think the book is actually necessary, probably now more than ever.
Very good. And I think it's a great book, and people need to read this. But, you know, it makes me think about what it was like when I first went into Congress in the 70s, because people never heard of libertarianism. But as they learned the term, frequently if a member would come up and say, you know, Ron, I'm a libertarian on this issue. But nobody ever came up to me and would say, you know what, I'm a socialist on this issue. They were in total denial. Even though that was their goal, it was unpopular. So I see one sign of what's happening, and you're alluding to it, is that it's much more prevalent. Even if they don't understand it, people are throwing this term around. Oh, I'm a socialist, and it sounds like a good thing. So that's, you know, an educational PR problem that we have. So that's why I think it's important for the young people and everybody to understand it. And I, of course, rejected socialism mainly because of an authoritarian approach. It's opposite of liberty. To have true liberty, you can't have, you know, a society that preaches a forced redistribution of worth and control of people. So to me, it's a very authoritarian violence, because I think socialism does lead, the more extreme it is, the more violence you have associated with it.
Well, I taught a course about a year ago at George Washington University up here on the dystopian novel. And in that, the students kept asking, you know, is violence inherent to socialism? Is authoritarianism an invariable thing that comes from socialism? And I think the answer is yes. And Hayek and others talked about this when they said, it isn't an accident that you get a ruthless dictator. If you really want complete socialism, where the state owns the means of production, takes the farms, takes the private property, the kinder, gentler sort of dictator, the kinder, gentler democratic socialist kind of doesn't work. What you end up selecting for if you want to take the property is you have to be ruthless, because the people will resist having their property taken. And so it isn't an accident. And if an accident, sort of coincidental that you get Hitler, you get Mao, you get Stalin, you get Pol Pot, and even now in Venezuela, you know, socialism has morphed into authoritarianism. We had this debate on one of the channels recently, and, you know, this woman on The View was screaming at me, no, Maduro's a thug, he's a thug, he's a murderer. And it's like, well, yes, and he's a socialist. But you can't deny his origins, and that we seem to have time and time again socialism devolving into authoritarianism.
You know, and one thing that's going on right now is the problems that we have today are being blamed, the free market and capitalism are being blamed by the socialists. And yet we have a system of interventionism, which is quite a bit different than what free markets are all about. So this is the reason I think people have to realize that interventionism is an authoritarian approach. It isn't where the government owns and controls all the means of production, but it produces a lot of special interests and special areas that have become socialistic. And of course, Mises in Human Action argued the case that if you have that type of a system, it will eventually go into a socialist system. And he suggested that that socialist system would be more fascism than communism.
And I think you're right. And some of the complaints that actually the left has are the same that we have. So we're not happy about crony capitalism. We're not happy about people using government to enrich themselves. And when we got to sort of the great banking crisis of 2008, 2009, there was a lot of us that didn't want to bail out the banks on the right. There were some on the left. So you got two different movements that started for the same cause, but had different differing ideas about how to fix it. So you had the Occupy Wall Street movement. Most of these were young kids who were from the left, and they wanted to basically embrace socialism because capitalism wasn't working. But you also got the Tea Party movement arising about the same time, and many of us wanted to go more towards a true form of capitalism where there was no crony capitalism, where the government wasn't bailing out the banks. And so you got Bernie Sanders voting against the bank bailout, and you also had people on the right voting against the bank bailout. But the left wasn't completely consistent in this because they voted to bail out the unions, the car unions. They just didn't vote to bail out the banks. And those of us on the right wouldn't have bailed out either and said, look, if you want to operate under capitalism, we're not going to let you keep the profits but socialize your losses. When you lose and make bad decisions, bankruptcy should be your reward.
You know, way back when I was in the debates, we had one debate. It was supposed to be on economic policy, and next week they said it's going to be on foreign policy. And I objected in many ways because I said you really can't separate the two, economic policy, and I think you've already explained it well, because one can lead to the other. But the economic policies are determined a lot by the foreign policy of spending and deficits and the use of aggression. So right now, we have to deal with a foreign policy that the excuse that they give, and I've heard you speak to this, and that is you can't use this whole idea that we have to be in Syria for our national security, or we have to go to Iraq to protect our Constitution by fighting an unconstitutional war. So this is a scheme, really, to continue the process of diminishing liberty for the sake of enhancing the government.
Well, you know, the term that we're at war, or we're in a certain part around the world because of our national security interest, is loosely thrown around. But I think the way you determine whether something's in your national security interest is basically you have to debate it. Everybody has a definition of what is in your national interest. And the way the Constitution set it up was that we didn't give the power to the president to decide. It was supposed to be a big, spirited debate over whether or not to declare war. It would be in Congress. And then we would debate and discuss what is in our national security interest. If we had that debate right now over Syria, I don't think it would be very clear what our national security interest is. In fact, I don't think we have one in Syria. Intriguingly, though, the left was pretty good about the Iraq war. They criticized George Bush. Some of us on the right did as well. But now the entire left-wing movement, it's hard to find a Democrat who will say, oh, you know, being in Syria is a mistake. Because Trump did it, and Trump is moving forces out of harm's way, now all the left completely has switched. Those who were opposed to the Iraq war are all now for inserting our troops into the Syrian war, but none of them want to have a vote on it because it'd be a messy vote, and none of them want to describe who the enemy is, because is the enemy Turkey? our NATO ally, is the enemy, the Free Syrian Army, who we were allied with for 7 years in the Syrian civil war. And the bottom line is, there may be something good come out of this, that finally there's going to be a discussion between the Kurds and Assad. What we have been preventing, and the U.S. policy has been for a regime change there, and by preventing any discussion with Assad, who looks like he's going to survive the civil war, if you prevent discussion with him, you'll never have peace. So my hope is that out of this, President Trump will encourage Erdogan from Turkey, from Syria, to have a discussion. And there's actually a possibility that the Kurds, who have been fierce fighters, can say to Assad, we will be fierce fighters for the Syrian government and for the country of Syria. If you give us some autonomy, maybe we could get in Syria to develop a semi-autonomous sort of a province with a certain amount of federalism, kind of like what they have in Iraq. And that's my goal, is not to see the Kurds wiped out, but actually to assist them, not assist them, but to enable them to talk to Assad and maybe find a place in Syria in allegiance with Assad.
You know, there are many in Congress, and you know who they are, and many people around politics right now are saying that Turkey has no right to invade a neighboring country, and we have to stop them. It is our duty to do it. But they never seem to ask the question. It never dawns on them, well, how did we get there? Were we invited into Syria by Assad? There's a bit of inconsistency. Have you ever thrown that out to a colleague and have them explain that to you?
That's a good point. Yeah, if Turkey has no right to be in Syria, what right does the U.S. have to be in Syria? But I think there are ways that we can influence Turkey. And so while I'm not a big fan of sanctions because they're on the whole population, I do think that we sell arms everywhere in the world and that really the arms race in the Middle East has largely been supplied by us. I think we could withhold arms. And so I have legislation today that I will introduce to say we shouldn't sell arms to Turkey. So maybe that could discourage them, or the withholding of arms could encourage them that they need to talk to Assad. I still think as a world power, we would have the ability to use our influence and our leverage to facilitate diplomacy. And that is something that I think is worthwhile. And people sometimes describe incorrectly, you know, the idea of isolationism, that we wouldn't be involved diplomatically. Actually, the idea of less military intervention doesn't mean that we wouldn't have diplomacy. In fact, I think diplomatically we should be engaged, and it's actually the neoconservatives in the War Caucus that are actually diplomatic isolationists. They don't want to talk to Assad. They don't want to talk to Putin. And I see an imperfect world, but I still would have relations and discussions and diplomatic ties to most people in the world. In fact, I think we should have more discussions even with Iran. Not that we excuse the type of behavior or excuse their government, but I think the more we talk, the less we'll fight.
And you know, the issues that you've talked about, and I know you will be willing to deal with other members of the Senate that have different views than libertarians, but and those are the people that may be constitutional conservatives and also, progressives. And to me, one of the most discouraging things in my period of time in politics has been and most recently, the disappearance of the principled progressive, because there's just so few around here. And it's also, it means that principles are put down way down on the list to the demagoguing of the partisanship, which is really a detriment. I would think those of us who promote, you know, this alliance with others, say, on civil liberties and war and selling weapons, this should be the wave of the future, because I tell you what, the propagandists, what's going on now with socialists getting into the Congress and setting the standards. So I think coalition building that I know you've participated in is a very wise step.
There is some right-left coalition still on not allowing the president to go to war in Iran without money being appropriated and without a war declaration by Congress. That's an issue that I've worked with Bernie Sanders and Murphy and others on the other side. On the war in Yemen, on not supplying arms to Saudi Arabia that they can use on the people in Yemen. So there is some coalition building, but there's also, unfortunately, some Trump derangement syndrome that when they see it. So, for example, with Iran and Saudi Arabia, the president's sort of been on the other side of these things, so it's easy for the progressives to ally with the right. And I've been willing to do that, even though I'm a supporter of the president. I've opposed him on sale of arms to Saudi Arabia. I've opposed him on our helping them in the war in Yemen. But then when it comes to Syria now, it's seen as a chance to take a partisan dig against the president. So while they're against the war in Yemen and our support for it, and they're against a new war in Iran, somehow they seem to be for a war in Syria. So they're inconsistent, but they're inconsistent because of partisan reasons. And I try to show them the example that you can be consistently against interventionism militarily, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. But unfortunately, a lot on the other side and some on our side only do it when it's convenient politically and the president's of the opposite party.
You know, I work under the assumption that Trump's foreign policy in the campaign was helpful to him, because I see that he was more for peace than Hillary and she was more for war. And I believe that position that Trump has now, he's more for peace than the Democrats. The Democrats are just down on him, which is totally contrary right. to what went on in the 60s. But this vote yesterday in the House, how bad do you think that is for our position, the 354 to 60? To me, it's a little bit discouraging, but I can't believe that represents the ratio of how the country's looking at this problem.
Yeah, no, I think the people are much more opposed to sending their sons and daughters to Syria. I think even military folks, I know people whose kids are now training to go into the military, they're not excited about going to Syria. The resolution that passed in the House yesterday is coming up in a few minutes. So as I leave this interview, I will go over and object to a unanimous consent that Chuck Schumer will put forward to say and criticize the president for leaving Syria. I will object to his unanimous consent, and I will offer up my own bill. His is a sense of the Senate, so it's not really legislation that binds anyone. Mine will actually be a bill, so I will object to his, and I will ask him for unanimous consent to discontinue arms sales to Turkey. In all likelihood, he would object to that, but it kind of gets to the point that they're actually putting forth something symbolic that will do nothing. I'm actually putting forward something they should agree with, which is if we don't like Turkey invading Syria, Syrian territory, and we want to tell them something, we can give them a message, a strong message, by saying, you know, while you're doing this, you're not getting any arms from the U.S., and I like my approach better. My approach also does not attempt to rebuke the president. And I think libertarians really across the country sometimes get trapped in the same thing as the Democrats, is they say, well, Trump's not a perfect libertarian and he's doing this in Saudi Arabia. Look, I object to the arms in Saudi Arabia, but when he does something right, I think libertarians should say, you know what? This is so much better than a Hillary Clinton or a George Bush. Any other Republican would already have us in another major war in Syria. If Lindsey Graham were president, can you imagine? So I think sometimes as libertarians, we should be aware that when someone's not a perfect libertarian but doing the right thing, we ought to at least commend them for doing the right thing at the right time.
Rand, I know we have to realize that this might be one of your most important interviews you have ever done. But nevertheless, of course, I've enjoyed it, and I know our viewers have enjoyed it. But I also know that you just described to us what else you're doing. And you're in the practical world, you're going to go down there and maybe not able to stop all this nonsense, but you're going to try to slow it up to the best of your ability. So, Rand, thanks a whole lot for being on with it today. And I sure hope you sell a lot of books and educate a lot of people about socialism.
Well, thank you. And I wanted to thank FreedomWorks. I'm in the FreedomWorks studio today for having me. And let everybody know that FreedomWorks is one of the groups that's in Washington really fighting for liberty.
Very good. Talk to you soon. And I want to thank our viewing audience today for tuning in. Please come back to the Liberty Report soon.